If we're investing in something that has more scientific risk to it, or like that sort of development risk, like obviously there's going to need to be key insights around that.
Yeah.
But I think around like what that sort of founder market fit needs to look like, we're still orienting around a lot of the same things. The expertise is going to be different, but you're still looking for a lot of those same attributes and the why this individual can do something in an industry that will make a big impact. Like, what is it that allows us to believe this individual or set of individuals can create something really special? Consumer insights and understanding problems in an enterprise are very different, so they're not going to look the same, but they're going to share some common attributes.
Hey climbers, welcome back to another episode of Climb by VSC. I'm your host, Jay Kapoor. Every week on this show, I chat with founders, investors, and industry experts about building and scaling companies in climate tech. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined in studio by Graham Brown, managing partner of Lair Hippo Ventures. Thank you so much for joining me, Graham.
Jay, thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. I mean, Lair Hippo has been one of the earliest investors in some iconic brands that everybody knows. Casper, Oscar, BuzzFeed, Mirror, Axios. I could keep going. And in late 2022, you guys announced $230 million across two new funds, still focused very much on pre-seed and seed for a lot of your focus. And Graham, you know, your background quickly, you first joined Lair 2015 as a senior associate, have climbed through the ranks and now become managing partner. And more recently, the fund has been an active investor in climate technologies and industrial automation, the kind of stuff that we love to talk about on this show. So I'm excited to dive into all that. Before that, just want to say thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for bringing me in here, man. Full circle. I think you're one of the first people I met in New York.
Wow. Yeah.
Once I joined Lair Hippo. Yes. I was at SoftBank for a period as well, and then sort of jumped in with both feet into seed with Lair Hippo, and like you and I met right after that, and so it's fun to be doing this.
I know, and maybe let's start there for our East Coast listeners. You started at Lair right around the time that I started my career in venture. We're both here in New York. I think back then, Lair was kind of the early New York funds, kind of recognizable OGs in this ecosystem. As we sit here almost 10 years later, lots of West Coast funds setting up offices in New York. Is New York VC still a differentiator, or we kind of priced that out of the market?
I mean, I think it is a market that is much, it has much more attention from everyone. It's gone through waves, right? But certainly like since 2010, when the fund was started, you know, you've seen 15, 16X growth in the amount of venture activity in the ecosystem. And you've also seen, I want to say when I joined, there was still a question of like, can a 5 or 10 or bigger billion-dollar type company be built in New York? And those questions have all been answered. You can build very large sort of generational type companies in New York. And you also have, I think, an extreme growth of tech talent over that period. So the ecosystem itself has grown so substantially where you see, you know, even coming out of the pandemic, market share in New York growing while other markets are shrinking as a relative overall market share. You still have the Bay Area as the biggest market, but New York is now clearly a number two, and there's just such a diversity of industry and founder here that you have your own sort of unique element. And I think New York focus or having a New York focus is a great platform to build off of, especially at the early stage. There are not a lot of durable barriers or differentiators in venture capital in most industries. I think one of the few is a network effect. There isn't a like hard network effect in the industry, but I think the closest thing you can get is a community and how that community grows. And as you add new founders to that community, does that founder pull value from it and add value to it? And by being focused on New York for the last 12 years, we now have the largest community of founders in the city. We invested in all of those founders before they were, you know, if they've become famous founders, before they were famous founders, but you know, at the, you know, at this very start of their careers and oftentimes their first startups. And so you have that like diversity and breadth that pays back, and refers in, and nurturing that community from an early days is something that the founders did incredibly well. And we've invested in that over the years. So I think having that presence, that connection, and then, a network into the different industries mm-hmm. in the city is incredibly valuable. Certainly if you're building in New York, but yeah. also if you're building elsewhere and New York is a relevant market for you, which it probably is for almost every company.
I think as the ecosystem in New York, you know, has matured, I was like reflecting back to when we met, I was at Techstars and, you know, we would always look at what the founder market fit of these earliest stage founders was. And a lot of them were pretty green about what it took to build a company. There wasn't really a lot of understanding of, you know, what founder market fit looks like, what product market fit looks like. We are well past that now, right? The maturity of the kind of average founder in terms of understanding what they need to know to go build a venture scale business has gotten that much higher and probably gotten a lot closer to what we were seeing 10 years ago at the Bay Area.
Yes.
And so I think that's been the biggest sort of like, the average founder is much more in the know. And that's just a natural sort of occurrence of an ecosystem maturing that we've, you know, gotten to see over the last decade.
Without a doubt. I mean, there was a period when if you were a founder in New York, seed, you were raising from angels.
Yeah.
Most of those angels came from finance or real estate or some of the other industries. And you had to have a very different conversation with a very different market than what you would have with a very educated market in the Bay Area and sophisticated market. And then by the time you were raising real institutional money, you had to get on a plane
yeah.
and go west. That is no longer
That's right.
the case. And there's lots of things that's happened, and it's true of all markets. It's no longer you have to be next to the VCs that invest in you, which is a good thing for the overall industry. But New York, you now have both the presence of VCs and a much larger and much more educated ecosystem. And it's still connected and collaborative in a way that it's an evolving and growing market. It is not a sort of set in stone, all of the key players are exactly as they have always been.
Yep.
And so there's still a lot of room for growth, and we're excited to continue to grow Lair Hippo here. We're about, I guess for context, we're about 60% New York founders.
Okay.
And so it is a meaningful part of the portfolio. It always will be, but we invest actively around North America as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. You know, we were talking about kind of the overall growth and maturity of founders. I've heard you say that communication, grit, and courage are three things that you look for in the founders that you are looking to back. I'm always curious when investors have these kind of rubrics, like what are the questions that you're asking these founders as you're meeting them that helps you discern those traits? And is there like a memorable story from a founder that kind of illustrated that to you?
Yeah, there's a, so we got plenty of stories. I'll share one relevant to the energy industry when I do share it, because fun to talk about climate here, and it's a big and important topic for us and an area of focus for us as well. But there's a, you know, there isn't like a dogmatic, like you have to answer this question a certain way, right?
Mm.
But there is, especially to pre-seed and seed, there's a huge human element to it in getting to know that person, not just as a CEO, but as a human in both ways, is a really important way to sort of understand what drives an individual,
yeah,
how committed they are to the cause, what things look like when they're not going in their favor, and what things look like when they're going really well, and there's a chance to sort of like get a little bit lazy as you're further along. And like, you're trying to suss that out as much as possible, getting to know an individual. And there's a, like, you look for that drive, like, what is this sort of like chip on the shoulder or the element that this person is going to do whatever it takes to accomplish their mission, if it's possible, right?
Yeah.
Or even if it's, you know, like, there's an element of doing the impossible here for all founders. And I think like you're really looking for that in the individual. I think when markets got really noisy and crowded, it became in vogue to be a founder. And like the difference between somebody who is doing this because it's the thing to do and it looks like you can make a lot of money, and like, okay, here are the 10 opportunities I'm thinking about, let me go with this one. Like that's not a reason for existence, and it's not a reason to build an outlier. And so you typically don't find outliers there. You find it when there's somebody who is just so obsessed with solving a problem and thinks about it in a different way. So one thing we are looking for is a unique insight that a founder has about an opportunity.
Yep.
And we need to decide whether or not that team is right to execute on that insight. And then whether that execution is in a market that is either sufficiently large or growing in a way that can lead to a sufficiently large outcome to have it make sense yep. for us as a fund.
Yep.
And we're trying to line those things up. But really the crux, I mean, it starts with the human. And so it's not just about like, pitch me the business. It's about, why are you doing this? What was your background? What led you to here? Why is this what you want to dedicate your life to? And then as you get to know a founder and you ask sort of second layer questions and you get, you know, if it's not something that we already have a prepared mind on, we're going to be getting smarter on that industry as we go. The founders that are truly obsessed with the problem and know it inside and out, you learn that as you ask those more complicated or different questions that are the specific nuances to their business. And the great ones sort of bring you in every time you're like, oh, well, what happens here when the industry does this or the competitor does this, and they're multiple steps ahead of you, and that comfort builds. And that's like a great sort of litmus test or thing I look for when you come out of every conversation feeling stronger and stronger about needing to back this founder. And we're tightened, like when we have that in a first meeting, like we're trying to do successive meetings like in right the away. Days after, right? To get to that as quickly as possible. Because it's about, in any market and in the current seed market too, it's, you know, part of this is speed to conviction and a belief in an individual, and how quickly can you build that?
Yeah, I think the piece that you mentioned about leading with your founder story, it's something that I find myself reminding not just the founders that we invest in, although, you know, generally they have a good sense of it. You know, even founders I'm meeting or mentoring, where it's like your first impulse is to make the first page of your deck about the problem or the really cool solution that you've built that nobody else can build. Tell me why nobody else can build it. Tell me why you have this earned insight, right? As Mike Maples calls it. Like, what have you done that gives you the right to have that earned insight? And a lot of founders skip that step, or maybe they come to the end. Like I see team pages and pitch decks and it's like page 14. It's like, so you've been talking to me for 13 pages and you haven't even told me why you're the best person to come tackle this problem. It seems obvious in hindsight, but I think founders get really excited about the what of what they're building, and they sometimes forget to talk about the who.
Yep. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And also, like, I mean, it's both ways too. And the founders also looking like they should be deciding on a part. You know, they want a fund that has good resources, good support, can help them, can open doors, and make sure that like they're being set up and have all the advantages possible to get to that product. For us, it's product market fit, right? Yeah. We're investing in everything pre-product market fit, and also help them figure out who their right partner for the next round is in the long run. But it's also like, you want someone you trust and you feel will give you good advice without being overly prescriptive in how you need to run that business for the long term. And it's not, you know, we maintain the relationship with our founders at that early stage. And we also like to be a first call when they're late stage and have raised hundreds of millions of dollars about, hey, how should we approach this problem? How should we think about the executive team as we evolve and go from a, you know, 150 person company to a 300 person company? And what should that look like? Like, we are looking to be a trusted advisor and partner for that founder over the long run.
Yeah.
And you want to have that, you want to people have as much conviction as possible that that is the person you want to be working with for 10, 15 years. And I think in, you know, in markets that become more transactional, what we saw in 2021, like you lose a lot of that.
Yeah.
And it becomes about price and dilution and optimizing that over all other things. And when markets get tougher, like they are now, like those things come back to bite you. And so like, I think it is a lot about like, the trust from both sides is so important in that relationship and so important for seed when you are as aligned with a founder as anyone will be on the cap table. And so we think about that a lot in every single process we run.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I think like to maybe give a tangible example here on some of these things, like I think about Chris Kemper from Palmetto. Chris Kemper at Palmetto is, you know, they're one of the now largest privately owned companies bringing solar and clean energy products to the residential market. We did their seed round in 2018. It was not a sector that was popular or there was a lot of money chasing. And Chris was a founder that had dedicated, you know, the past 20 years of his life to the category in different cycles, and including through sort of CleanTech 1.0 the aftermath of that, and was still in it and had learned the elements of like what it is to finance this, what it is to distribute and put a solar panel on a roof, and how you sell it, and how you tie all the different constituents together. And he had, you know, seen and lived with the Sunruns and all the companies of the world that built large vertically integrated businesses, which ultimately like limit your flexibility. And his sort of perspective and insight was, we can do this in a much more asset light way, and we can do it in a way that removes soft costs. So what's a barrier to clean energy and renewable energy in the residential market? The hardware costs have come down 80-90%. Yeah. It's the soft costs.
Yeah.
It's the cost of customer acquisition.
Yep.
It's the cost of the labor that goes into both selling, which has largely been a door knocking business, and the dollars that go into bringing hardware to the home, installing it on a roof, and going through that whole process. There's permitting. There's all these things that go around it. And so with technology, what can we automate? And can we think about this more of a platform or business in a box way, where we can build the technology layer and the different people that are in this industry selling the product, installing the product, financing the product? Can we connect all those pieces in a more efficient way? And that was sort of like the ground, like him having seen multiple cycles and thinking about what's the one thing I want to do.
Yeah.
I want to increase the use of renewable energy in the United States. How can I best do that? I can solve this soft cost problem in the most efficient way possible. And he brought all those insights. And so, you know, when we met Chris, it wasn't an area, again, we questioned like, what's the downstream capital market look like for this type of business? Like, what's the future where this can get to be a really big business, and how should we think about it? But like when we met Chris, he educated us on why these insights and his background was the way that you could actually build a more efficient model, and a model that could get to profitability much more quickly than the status quo.
And I
think that sort of thing, and like you also couple with like you see a founder dedicating their life 20 plus years to an industry in good times and bad times, especially in a long period of bad times, that person is not going to change.
They're not fair
mind.
Weather. Yeah.
They're not fair weather.
Yeah.
They are in it.
Yeah.
Because it's their life's work.
Yeah.
And like finding that in a founder is a like key element, and it's a hard thing to find.
It's
and
a rare so, thing. It's
and
a rare
so,
thing.
Like those are the, you know, I think that in this industry specifically, that's an example we think about a lot. And I think like at seed, to make really, really big returns, you've got to take the risk on backing something that isn't consensus, but you believe has a path to being consensus and the way the future will be.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a lot of how we thought about Chris and Palmetto in the early days.
That's a super helpful example. And I think it ties into kind of the earned insight, but also the why now, right? You talked about the labor costs coming down, and there's almost sometimes like a friction between the costs have come down, but the consumer adoption isn't quite there. And this is the startup that, you know, is going to bridge that a little bit. Couple of different directions we can go, because I want to talk about this idea of prepared mind, you know, as a generalist fund. But before we dive into that, you mentioned this idea of, you know, customer acquisition, building a business that can actually like grow and scale into this problem with, you know, profitable unit economics one day. Like at the stage of that pre-product market fit that you're looking for, I mean, are there key markers or metrics that you look for that show you that this founder understands the customer problem and can actually build a business with, you know, one day healthy unit economics?
Yeah, it comes back to that founder obsession with the problem and solving that in a better way. I think we're like we, and I think others make mistakes in the industry, is focusing too much on the metrics today versus what this can be in the future. And when we've made decisions on great metric businesses versus the insight in the obsession with the problem and this being a problem that needs to be solved in a better way, you know, those outcomes don't tend to be the ones that are really special companies.
Really?
And you know, early days, $1 million in revenue. Like, by the way, that's a helpful data point.
Yeah.
But it's not the reason to invest when you're so early. The reason to invest is what this business can look like a long term in the future, and can this founder take that company there?
Yeah.
And so with, you know, within that industry, like we look at a, look at a world like rising temperatures, increasingly chaotic weather events that are hugely costly, an educated consumer that is thinking about this more and more, and a need for change and not knowing where it comes from. You look for things that can help enact that change and accelerate it. Mm-hmm. And so something like a business that helps us produce energy in a more renewable way and can do it at scale,
yeah,
is a business building with long-term tailwinds. You know, there's going to be fluctuations up and down, working towards an inevitability, we believe, which is how do we reduce the carbon footprint of how we produce energy, and how do we reduce the carbon footprint of how we consume energy?
Yeah.
And when you own the home, you're tying in both the vehicle as well as energy production and consumption in the home. And those things make up a huge, huge factor across the world.
Yeah. I don't disagree with any of that. I guess the thing that I'll sort of push back on and I want to dig in a little bit deeper on is, like, you know, for founders, like, these metric goalposts, they keep moving, right? They hear from one investor, oh, $1 million in ARR gets you this kind of round. They come back with $1 million in ARR, and the found, you know, the investor is like, oh, sorry, it's actually two, or it's 2.5, or it's 70% gross margin, or whatever. And so I want to agree with everything that you're saying, that look, ultimately it's about that founder market fit, that earned insight, that market that's ripe for disruption. And yet, you know, we still need to know that there's going to be a healthy business at the end of the day, right? And so I'm maybe not then markers or metrics, but like beyond the founder, are there signals that you're trying to pick up on?
Yeah. I'll drill on that a little, in on that a little more. It's not that we're not looking, by the way, difference at Series A, different at Series B, different at Series C, where you start to know more and more about what the sustainability and repeatability of those metrics are, and you shift more towards an execution game. At that earliest stage, I think my point is more, if we are making the decision solely based on early metrics looking interesting, we're using the wrong piece of information to make that decision for a big outcome. Yeah. Now, it could factor in, and it should. Yeah. And I think it is a founder understanding their business model and levers and what that looks like is really important, even if we know it will change.
Yeah.
And so investing in a business that we know for the foreseeable future will have negative gross margins, right? Like, that's something we're going to think about and factor in, right? Yeah. And so that part, you're absolutely right. It's just more a matter of like the traction in the earliest days isn't generally the most important thing to look at. In fact, almost never. There are elements of like sometimes when you get something really special in consumer and you see some really interesting small like virality and factors, like that can help to make the bigger story really, really compelling.
Yeah.
But it isn't the sole factor we're making a decision on.
Yeah.
And as you get later and later, like the weight you can put in those metrics become more and more important. But for sure, like capital efficiency and ability to achieve like milestones along the way are incredibly important.
Yeah.
And a big part of our onboarding process and thinking about just being a financially fit, tight, efficient company over time versus a growth at all costs type environment.
Yeah.
And so that is, I mean, I think that part is a very important point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what I'll tell founders sometimes is like, it's not so much the number that matters. It's the proven ability to like sell and close a deal and close a customer. And so if the number is 500K, not a million, but you know, within your, let's say ACV, it's 50K and you've sold 10 customers, then that to me makes me feel more confident that you'll sell the 11th as opposed to, well, you know, I sold, I don't know, one, or maybe it's a pilot or something, right? I think, and again, every company's different and every, you know, industry within climate itself is different. But I think it's, to me, along the same lines of what you're talking about, yep. It's like, it's a helpful data point, and it's not the number necessarily that matters. It's what that number signifies.
Yes.
To me. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And in at pre-seed, these businesses don't have metrics.
Yeah.
Seed sometimes.
Yeah.
Rarely is there $1 million in revenue to look at the seed. I think what we do look for, especially if it's B2B, is customer validation and their need and value and how they talk about that product and team.
Yep.
And so how do they talk about what that product is doing for them, how they see it in the organization in the future, how they would think about talking about that product with their peers. And then also a lot on how they talk about that team and like what that team means to them. And oftentimes you're going to both validate things that we're trying to validate on the founders because it's founder-led sales at that stage.
Yeah.
And then also early signals on product market fit as much as possible. And so those two things are incredibly important. And there's obviously a metric there.
Yeah.
It's usually tied to, you know, revenue, usage, an ROI that that customer is thinking about. But it's less so on, you know, we need to see X dollars in revenue today for us to get excited about an opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you. Coming back to this idea of, you know, kind of generalist in a world where trends are shifting, right? It was D2C in the early days of Lair here in New York. And then more recently, you know, Web3 and NFT was a big thing. I know that wasn't, you know, a big focus for your portfolio, but now AI and climate. We've seen funds that have cropped up over this last decade cycle focus specifically around that, right? Or defense tech or supply chain. But Lair has stayed fiercely generalist. As you talk to founders, as you look to, you know, win these deals, talk to me about the benefit of being a generalist investor as opposed to kind of choosing a sector and being a sector focused lead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it allows us to orient on that earliest stage on a founder building something special that we are not necessarily trying to hunt that specific thing. I think in most sectors now, we're going to come in with a fairly prepared mind because if we're doing our job and we are doing our best to do our job in a really good way, like we are going to have a presence in an industry before it becomes the industry that everyone wants to invest in.
Yeah.
Because we're following where the best people are building and we're partnering with those people to build companies. And we are through that, I think, building both like a bench of founders and founder experience, like take Chris at Palmetto.
Yeah.
He is now an incredibly active angel in the category and we'll look at things together and we'll be able to use his insights perspective as diligence as well as shared deal flow. And so you start with sort of like something before it becomes the thing everyone is investing in. And you're building that expertise early. It's not going to be the only thing we're looking for, but it allows you to tackle big categories in very early ways. I think it works well as a pre-seed seed fund.
Yeah.
Where, again, we're especially orienting around that founder and that founder insight. And we're there to help them build their business. We never want to have more knowledge about them than their company
and
their
sector.
But we can help them as they think about going to 0 to 1 and scaling that go to market and the early hires and the early foundations and best practices that you need to put in to make this next round and really set that foundation where you can scale in a better way and build your company in a healthier way. And so that common thread across all these companies is something that we have done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times.
Yeah.
And we can help founders achieve that while they bring their expertise on the problem they're solving. And then sort of by way of portfolio breadth over time and that sort of growing and compounding over time, we're going to have connections and introductions and ties into sector-specific areas that can be valuable in any sector that that founder is thinking about.
Yeah, so looking at the breadth of your portfolio, as I mentioned, right, some of these iconic brands at the top of our conversation, and now more recently with some more of the climate companies, including Palmetto, but a few others that you've backed, are there things that you need to see from climate founders when they're pitching you or as you're doing diligence on the business that are different from those in kind of general tech? Are there certain markers that you want to hear from these climate founders specifically?
If we're investing in something that has more scientific risk to it or like that sort of development risk, like obviously there's going to need to be key insights around that.
Yeah.
But I think around like what that sort of founder market fit needs to look like, we're still orienting around a lot of the same things. The expertise is going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still looking for a lot of those same attributes and the why this individual can do something in an industry that will make a big impact. Like, what is it that allows us to believe this individual or set of individuals can create something really special? Like, we're doing a very similar thing across categories, right?
Yeah.
Now, consumer insights and understanding problems in an enterprise are very different, so they're not going to look the same.
Yeah.
But they're going to share some common attributes, and that's the really important on the human part. And then I think every sector and category is going to have its own nuances that we're going to look for, and particularly some of these industries that have less digital penetration, but are big categories where you see the path, you see where the future's going. Like, we'll take supply chain and logistics. Like,
yeah.
We backed a team there that has done phenomenally well, and part of it was they were able to pair what technology can do best with a deep understanding and empathy for what people in freight were dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And having both of those was the magic for what makes that business special and really take off in the early days versus coming in and saying, this technology will change your life, adopt it. Or like, this is the, like, we are disrupting your industry.
Yeah.
And so I think there are some categories where that like, real understanding of the problem and how the market works and trust with the players that you need to generate revenue and drive scale, plus being able to see how technology will change things is that sort of like magic moment that we are looking for.
Yeah.
There are, you know, there are things in healthcare. I think some things in energy fit that really well also. Like, you know, if Chris was just an outsider who, you know, was coming in with his first startup to tackle energy, you know, maybe we would have gotten there, but like, it's a lot easier to like validate that mission and drive and like the fact that they are not going to give up ever and do whatever it takes when that founder has been in that space for an extended period of time.
Yeah. I find it particularly difficult when it's a first time founder, you know, coming from, especially in climate, as we've spent time, academia, or they've come from, you know, more of sort of a lab setting and sure have some unique earned insight, don't have the experience or expertise of having built a business and hired people and understanding how long that takes or how much it costs. And, you know, it's challenging sometimes to say, we know this works in a lab setting. We know this works for your PhD dissertation. Is it going to scale like a company? I think we have a different problem in some of those kind of industrial automation contexts because you have folks that come from industry and move at the pace of industry.
Yep.
And there's a little bit of education to be done of like, hey, if you're taking venture capital, you are setting the expectation that you're going to grow 3X, you know, if not year on year, then at least round to round, right? And sometimes there's that conversation to be had when you see a forecast or a projection or a market sizing and you're like, guys, I don't think you're understanding what you're signing up for here. So, you know, I tend to find that there's like education be done on kind of both sides of that conversation.
Yeah, I agree. And there isn't one founder archetype we look for.
Yeah.
But I think for sure, your point and the point that I'll echo here is that like when someone comes from the industry, it's that sort of rare connection where they're thinking very differently than the rest of their industry has thought, right? It's not like if someone has been in an industry and knows everyone but moves at the speed of the industry, like, you're not going to have a giant outcome probably, right? Like, yeah. it's not going to be what you're, like, what makes sense for venture. And so a lot of that is, yes, deep understanding of the problem and thinking differently about a better way to solve it.
Yeah.
That's a great combination for some of these older school industries where relationships and the nuance of how things work really matter.
Yeah. You know, one of the things we touched on at the top of it was, you know, we're coming off of this like 2021, you know, party hard. We're kind of through the hangover right now. Some say the hangover is going to last a little bit longer. One of the biggest markers of the 2021 party hard was how big funds got. And folks that tripled, quadrupled their fund sizes, fund over fund. And yet we saw a lot of these multi-stage folks, you know, come down to seed and compete to lead seed rounds. I think one of the things that I really admired about Lair is how disciplined the approach has been to pre-seed and seed. I mean, talk to me about what fund size does when it comes to you competing for deals and what fund size means in the context of a founder when they're taking money from one of those funds.
Yeah, I think it's a, I mean, what's true in the market of having, multiple options for founders, great, right?
Sure.
But I think it is very important to, for the round you're raising, what's the right alignment and incentives you want? And fund size does matter a great deal there.
Yeah.
Right? For us, we're a lead seed investor. Some, you know, typically $1 to $3 million type of initial checks. Every check we write is a meaningful part of our fund. And we're successful when that company and founder is successful with that initial check, and we'll follow on obviously and support that company, but we're not looking to deploy a certain amount of capital to make it meaningful to the fund.
Mm-hmm.
And we are also invested in helping that founder through harder times when it's less clear about how this becomes a big business. And that happens a lot at the Series A, the Series B, the Series, you know, we look at early funds and what broke out really quickly, what took a long time to compound. And you see a lot of these examples of companies that like 4, 5, 6 years later, like this is going to be a really valuable business.
Yeah.
It wasn't an obvious early breakout. And there were a lot of challenges that we had to work through. To have a partner that is with you and focused on, because again, you are a meaningful part of their fund and you are their core strategy. Through that journey is a big deal.
Yeah.
And for a fund to always be a positive signal at that next round, because what we want to be best at and what we continue to build and what we want to do for the next 20 years and be best at is pre-seed and seed. That's it.
Yeah.
Like that's our focus. And that alignment means there's never going to be confusion around why are we not stepping up and doing the next round? It also means that we're not in a situation where, hey, your first shot didn't work out exactly the way we wanted to. That's fine. Let's shut the company down. Let's move on to the next thing. You know, we've got a fund that's big enough where you are 0.1% of our fund.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an impact, right? And
yeah.
So like we want to align those two things as much as possible and stay true to that early stage lead investor that's partnering up with founders and in a way that we can be collaborative with others.
Yeah. I you know, it's so interesting to me to hear you say that, because I feel like a lot of funds, it's just gotten easy to say, oh, look, we're multi-stage. We're going to come into pre-seed and seed. We're going to put a, you know, $5 million check or you know, whatever. And you as a founder have to realize if they're putting a $5 million check into your company, they've got a $50 million check over there and they're on both boards and you're expecting that the level of attention you're going to get for somebody who has 10x more dollars invested in them is going to be equal to the one that you're getting. It's a little silly, I think, right? And you have to kind of realize like I don't want to go so far as to say, you know what, maybe I will. You're an option bet for a fund. And they're hoping to track you. And if you do well, they're going to come in. But if they don't, there's that negative signal that you just talked about. And I think there's an optimism that founders have initially when they're like, look at the brand, look at the name, they're leading my round, it's great. And not realizing that if things do not go as planned and you're not out there raising a mega follow-on round, the partner at that fund, right or wrong, they're not really incentivized to sit there and spend that time with you. It's only when you've been through that that I think a founder realizes, like, oh, yeah, I guess I was the option bet.
Yeah, and there's a team size element that goes into, like, there's all these things that go into that, yeah. Right? Like, we're, I don't love the word boutique, but, like, think like a boutique-focused experience, like, we think about ourselves a lot as, like, there is a boutique-specialized experience and strategy that we want to do and improve upon year after year and be the best at. And I think that type of focus is what gives you durability.
Yeah.
In a strategy. And I think it's what's, you know, worked well from the beginning. We've evolved as the fund size has grown and, you know, as we've sort of shifted and broadened the different areas that we invest in and the services we offer. And you know, now we're over $1 billion AUM. And so you combine like that specialist approach where, again, we want to do one thing really, really, really well with the resources of a fund much bigger because of the AUM we have and the community we have. Like, we want to tie those two things together in a really special offering for founders. And I think, like, you know, in addition to that human element, like, that is a valuable proposition for any team looking to begin their journey, right? Yeah. Like, that's what we want to focus on. I think there's some multi-stage funds that, you know, do seed in a great way. But, like, it is, you have to know as a founder what it is you are taking when you take that.
Yeah, yeah. And $1 billion AUM is not boutique, by the way. I'm going to see you. You were about to say boutique, and I was like, I don't think so.
Exactly. But, like, right, small investment team.
Yes.
Right? You have a very small investment team. Every partner is a meaningful voice in the partner meeting.
Yep.
Everybody is focused on helping, you know, particularly as right after we make that investment, like getting that company to product market fit and raising a great Series A and, you know, growing from there. And, you know, we have different resources for different stages, but like we're going to be there along the way. I think the key thing there is, you know, it's really around like, and I think some of the best funds have done this really well. Like, you maintain with a team size that big, and each fund is not massive, right? Like, you maintain a boutique feel and an individual experience for every founder that is very hard to do when you get to another level of scale.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part of when I think about like specialization and what that experience is for a founder. Like, you can get both worlds where like, there are real platform resources and a lot that comes along with having, you know, 8 seed funds and done this for many years and having that network, but then also having that really small, tight team that is, again, they're focused on one thing.
Yeah.
Pre-product market fit, helping those companies go from 0 to 1.
Yeah.
And that's a different experience than, you know, a fund that has multiple billions of AUM and what that infrastructure on that team looks like and all of those things.
Yep.
And so it's a, you know, I think when I think about boutique, I think about a more like what's the specialization and what's that experience for the founder? And less so about like AUM size, right? The AUM size is meaningful and it gives us, again, resources that we can help founders with in different ways.
Totally. We talked about it, what it means for the founder. I'm curious what it means for you as a fund. Have there been situations where, you know, you're vying to lead a deal, heads up against a multi-stage fund for whom a 40 post and a 50 post are really not that different, whereas for me, that's probably the difference between whether I do a deal or not. Have there been situations where you've actually been able to convince a founder to say, we're the right guys for you to have as your board partner?
Yeah, it's part of what we have to do. Yeah. you know, there gets to be an extreme where, you know, it may be hard to line things up. But I think I see that less now. But in a competitive deal, one of the last deals we did, it was a deal in energy.
Yeah.
Many term sheets. We were not the highest offer, but we were a good offer and a very fair offer, and an offer that gave that company the right amount of capital to get to where they needed to go. And then also a partner that company wanted to work with and they thought could help them a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So like there's an element of 10 on 50. Like we're talking different ballparks, but like we're not trying to win on price, right? We're winning on what is a fair deal and a trust and a relationship and being able to really help that founder and speed to conviction and sort of the things that are going to matter in that early relationship. We're often not the highest bidder. And you know, I think these are things that like, I joined 8 years ago, the firm was started over 12 years ago, like with enough repetition and enough like doing this over and over again, like you can have the references and the brand and the credibility to, you know, help do that in a way where you can, you know, win a highly competitive deal with multiple ranges. And there are, founders are thinking about right fund for right stage more and more.
Yeah.
Or at least we're seeing that. Mm-hmm. And there's been plenty written and like a lot of great things written about, hey, the fund size and how that aligns with your round. That matters.
Yeah.
It's not the only thing that matters.
Yeah.
But it matters. And it says something about what that relationship is going to be like. And so I think that, again, just going back to that trend of like early New York versus New York now, like there's just more information, more content. Everyone is more educated about different stages. And I think like at Seed, that's something that comes up.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I've heard you say that, you know, I really admired was like, you want to create value for a founder even when you're passing. And I think, you know, when I was a young investor, the pass notes were the hardest ones for me to write, because especially when you're spending weeks getting to know a founder, getting to know a team, and ultimately for one reason or the other, you end up, you know, not getting across the finish line. Maybe it's price, maybe it's something else. I'm curious as you kind of train now your team, folks that are looking at deals, like how do you pass on a founder when it's not something kind of extrinsic or about the business, like market size or you know, the product, you know, maturity, but it's actually the founder. You know, we talk so much about founder market fit when ultimately it comes down to, we're not sure that you're the right person to build this thing. How can you still create value in a pass?
So there's value in a pass in how transparently you're sharing information and what the founder does with that, right?
Yeah.
And founders can take that in, you know, we're all humans. We can take that in different ways and use it, you know, for fuel. We can use it and become, you know, depressed about how things are going. Like there's lots of ways it can be used. I guess I think about it less in those terms. Like we want to be as transparent as possible, right?
Yeah.
Like, and we're going to share whatever can be helpful, but there's no reason to like be mean about something, right? Like, and so like there's a kindness and there's a constructive way to do that. I think that's like, that's a unique art, and you want to do that as much as possible. But like, oh, there's also throughout that process, like what introductions can we have made that made us smarter, but can also help you.
Mm.
And especially when we're going deeper with teams, like we always want to leave value there for the founders in any way we can. And even if we're not investing and we've done our diligence, like we'll think about intros that could be useful for that founder to make. It's not really useful as if we pass and make an intro to another investor. So we're not offering that.
Yeah.
I think that's never a great signal, but like we can help in a lot of other ways.
Yeah.
And so thinking about that experience and how we can, you know, I think B is like, empathetic, transparent, and helpful through a process that is often not transparent and is really hard as possible.
Yeah.
And whatever it is about the business, we're going to disagree with the founder on that, right?
Yeah.
They're doing this because they don't believe that, and we're not doing it because that's what we believe, and that's okay.
Yeah.
And we're often wrong. You know, it's like in those early days, those are judgment calls.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of what else outside of that can we be helpful with?
Yeah. I tell founders too, I'm like, this is going to sound, it's going to feel personal, but it's not, right? Ultimately, it's what we've learned and the conviction that we've built or what we've heard from the experts or the customers that we've talked to. And it can be a small sample size sometimes. I may have gone and spoken to a larger customer than the one that's going to turn out to be your ideal customer. At this stage, it's so hard to know sometimes that I you know, come back to like, yeah, this was the hardest thing that I was doing as a young investor and remains one of the harder things that you have to do, especially when you get to know a business and you get to know a founder. Maybe you like the business a little bit more than you like the founder. It's hard sometimes to be honest, empathetic, yeah, and still create value in that pass.
Yeah, and these are long journeys. Yeah. Like, I'll give you, my partner recently invested in a company. She got to know, she met many times and passed on a previous round on a previous company, and ultimately came in and made an investment. And that opportunity came back to her because of that relationship that was developed despite a pass. And like having that element and trust there is really important. We see things come back around all the time.
Yeah.
And we're not we've passed on it once and we'll never look again, right? Yeah. Because we're big believers in adjusting our frameworks and how we think about things and our conviction as things change and more information comes. And so, I think that's also an element here. You know, if we're not doing the pre-seed, many times we ultimately come in and pay a higher price and do the seed.
Yeah, fair enough. Graham, we're all close. Where I like to close with a lot of our guests is talking about cause for optimism, right? Especially we're a climate podcast. There's a lot of doom and gloom out there. And yet some of it we think may continue in 2024. So I know I quoted this to you before, but you know, we heard Bill Gurley say that he expects 2024 to be a lot more of the same. His reasoning being, look, there's a lot of dollars in the venture ecosystem and the startup ecosystem that have to kind of run their course through the venture body, as it were, before we return to some level of normalcy. If you're advising a founder that's trying to fundraise in 2024, what do you think should give them optimism or encouragement as they're kind of going into this year?
At what stage?
Pre-seed and seed. Where you
seed,
invest, man.
Of course. Yeah. That's what I want to talk about. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah.
I think now in many ways is a great time to start a company. And there's always challenges. Yeah. But actually at seed, there are fewer companies being funded, but there's real dollars going to those companies.
Yeah.
And you know, there's an act seed and pre-seed market going on right now. And you've got a moment in time where the war for talent isn't what it was. Even the big companies right now, right? Like,
yeah,
it's more about hiring freeze than any great talent. We will pay whatever it takes. And you have to convince, you know, you small startup have to convince them that your equity is more attractive for wherever they are in their life.
Yeah.
And so I think you've got a time where it's easier and better to hire. I think we've got new tools. I mean, early days of what we're seeing with Copilot and efficiency, like I think you can be more efficient with less, and you've got less routing in many ways. And so I think now's actually a very interesting time to be building at the early stage. And there is an active seed market in a way that looks very different than downstream, right? And I think there's a lot change in growth in 2024. I hope so, but I don't bet on it.
Yeah.
I think 2025 starts to look different. And as you progress on, for sure, but there's a lot of things that still need to unwind and a lot of sins from earlier years that we're all paying for. And like, that didn't resolve itself all in 2023.
Yeah. I think we're going to see a lot more founders build with capital efficiency in mind, build with, justifiable metrics, if not today, but, you know, down the line, like this business actually makes sense without hundreds of millions of venture capital. And I think we're going to be, we as an ecosystem are going to be better for it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you look at some of the bad behavior that came out of blitzscaling, look, it built some really great businesses, but maybe not all of them needed to have existed, or not all of them could have existed at the scale that they did. I think we as an ecosystem are going to be smarter and better for it. And so that's the optimism and encouragement that I take from that answer.
I think it's a great time to be, like, and it's also, there's an, starting a company now, like, takes real conviction.
Yeah.
And, like, doing hard things, like, there was a period there where almost anyone could start a company with a solid idea and raise no matter what and do it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And now it has to be for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important element. And I think we see that in a lot of the founders that are pitching us today. I think in some of these categories that are a little out of favor, that's even more elevated, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I think there's a lot of things that are exciting and to be optimistic about. And we have, you know, I'm glad we didn't talk about it because we could have spent the whole time talking about AI.
Yeah.
But we have a technology shift and potentially complete revolution that is happening now. And so, like, thinking about where that can be used in better, more durable ways and new ways, and, you know, problems that haven't been solved in better ways. Like, I think there's just a lot of opportunity for, like, you know, really smart people that, you know, want to build something today to begin fresh and to begin in a healthier environment.
Yeah. And I would encourage them, especially if they're building in climate, to reach out to Lair Hippo, to reach out to Graham, to reach out to us. Hey, we're here, we're active, we're investing at seed stage.
We need more. We need more.
Yes, we do.
We've got a new one we'll be announcing, which is, like, we think an enabler for technology development in the space, but, like, there just needs to be more.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited to hear about that. Graham, yeah. Thank you so much for joining me on Climb today. We'll make sure we link all your socials and your bios and all that stuff so folks can find you. But really just want to thank you for joining me on the show.
Awesome. Jay, really enjoyed it, man. Thanks for the questions. This was fun.
This was great.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for this episode of Climb by VSC. I want to thank my guest, Graham Brown from Lair Hippo, for joining us on the show. And did you know that you can watch as well as listen to episodes of Climb? Head on over to YouTube and you can check out full videos of the show as well as clips from the show every week. And if you enjoyed the show, we'd love for you to leave us a 5-star review on Spotify and iTunes. And if you love the show, we'd love recommendations of a guest to have on here. Send them over. That's it for now. Thank you so much for watching Climb by VSC. We'll see you next week.